Welcome to episode one of the Willie's World podcast. Dopest dop you're ever going to smoke. Today we're in the, well, not actually in the studio, we're over Zoom and we're having a COVID conversation with the one and only photographer extraordinaire, Mr. Andrew Christie, aka Crispy, Chronicles of Crispy. Chronicles of Christie, I apologize. So tell me, Crispy, how's life treating you in lockdown? Obviously, we're starting to come out of this shit now. Slowly but surely. What's been going on the northern beaches in Sydney?
It's been good. I don't know. It's hard to see this much difference. Like, the beaches are still super crowded. The surf's been more crowded than ever. Like, I guess it's school holidays and there's a lot of people that probably lost their jobs, so everyone's surfing. It's probably been busier than ever.
So how's biz been since lockdown started?
To me, I lost everything. I had no jobs. All jobs I had were cancelled because they involved more than 35 people. And then I got a lot of other work, just filming real estate and stuff, but things that people couldn't need to get on video to show. So then it ended up being like really busy. So it's kind of, now the lockdown's over, it's kind of got quiet again. So it's kind of needed that.
Right. So give us a little bit of background. You're from the Northern Beaches originally, and you've been a surf photographer for what now? Like 18, 20 years almost?
Yeah, I pretty much started shooting and surfing when I was at school and met a few, like the Northern Beaches was the best place to get started then too. So you want all the top surfers in the world lived around here. All the interest was on the Northern Beaches. So while I was at school, I was starting to hook up with a lot of the good surfers and, get a few shoots happening and, just grew from there.
And who were some of the people that put you on when you were a kid that kind of like your inspiration around the Northern Beaches or on an international level that were shooting for Surfer Magazine and Tracks and, ASL or Waves? You worked with a lot of different magazines. How did it originally kind of... For people out there who want to get a start, how did you come about getting into photography?
Yeah, so my route started. I did work experience, and this was down at the beach one day, and there was a surf photographer there, Sarge, and he gave me a huge start in the surf photography world, and very cool, positive, and he taught me quite a lot about how much work it takes to be a photographer and how much work it takes to be consistent.
So for the people out there, that Sarge, who was he? Was he a photographer that worked for Tracks, was he? A senior photographer?
Tracks, and he was kind of the main photographer for Tracks at the time, and he was traveling on the tour with all the top guys, and he had a video out there too, Sarge's scrapbook, which... document like all over the early tour, like through the 90s, and it was pretty like it really like can show what happened on that period of time. Like, so that was a lot of work to do with Sarge, and he's just taught me like a lot of how to do the job properly and so on. Made a lot of contacts with that, and also got to know a lot of the surfers, and then. When I was 18, I started to do my own thing, and did my first trip. I went to Africa, which was supposed to be 3 weeks, ended up being like 8 or 9 weeks, and that was a big trip. And then, just kind of like did a lot of odd jobs and did all random stuff, washing dishes or whatever, till I could work full time.
So who were some of the surfers that were the hot shit around the Northern Beaches? Obviously, back in the early 90s, they had the Coke Classic at Narrabeen and then once at Manly, I think. That was pretty influential, obviously. A lot of traveling pro surfers. Sydney was still was a hot spot in the surfing world, not so much these days. Who were some of the people that you got to shoot with when you were a kid and that you used to see on a, day-to-day basis around the traps?
Yeah, I guess the first few surfers you'd have like Nathan Webster and Tom Carroll, Richie Lovett, Button Lynch. They were kind of like a lot of the main guys. Rob Bain, shot with Bainey a lot. That was my first photo that I published was with Rob Bain in Tracks. And But yeah, just and then like a lot of younger guys, you know, guys like Ozzy, you know, we're just coming up through the ranks, and you know, Ozzy's
Ozzy Wright, friend of yours, yeah. Volcom yeah. writer extraordinaire.
Yeah, and Ozzy was writer for S&P at the start, and then you know, Volcom was just beginning here, and they were pretty much running out of the garage in someone's house and their family, and they you know, went big and grabbed Ozzy on a big deal, and you know, Ozzy's still a part of Volcom now, and he's been a huge influence in that company over the years. And yeah, Ozzy's became through Volcom as well, and both living in Narrabeen, became, you know, probably the main surfer I shot with throughout the years until he moved to Byron.
So that relationship was pretty fruitful for you guys, for both of you. You shot a lot of his campaigns and, you know, got a lot of work from Volcom. How long did you work for Volcom for?
So I was probably with Volcom since I started in Australia in, what, you know, 98, 97, 98. And then I was doing so much work for him. We worked out a deal to be on the staff retainer with him, like, 2005. And from then till 2016, I was on retainer. And that was great. Between Australia, Europe and America, traveling between Australia and France and Possegor, and then Hawaii for the winter. And yeah, it was really good. It was a great deal.
And so back in the day, I remember as a grommet growing up on the Northern Beaches, you know, Volcom was the hot brand. You know, it started out with SMP, and then Volcom kind of became the hot surfwear brand if you're under 15 to rock. You know, no one really wore Billabong or Quicksilver, maybe Quicksilver a little bit. You know, that would have been some pretty interesting years. You got to go on tour to some pretty crazy places. Can you tell us a few stories about that time period? Like, how did you first get involved with Volcom, and kind of how did you step up your photography as it moved along, and what kind of stuff was expected of you when you were on retainer? Did you shoot catalogs, and, you know, obviously there was it a pretty day to day was pretty changing?
Yeah, there's a big diverse range of stuff I had to shoot for them. So it wasn't just the surfing. Shot a lot of the catalogs, and just did a lot of in-house videos as well. Some video ads, making videos for the surf shops, just install video loops, and then the catalog shoots. But whatever, it just depends on, you know, if I was available to do stuff. So a lot of the catalog shoots, they just got guys like Steve back and that to shoot those. I just wasn't there enough to do all that stuff consistently. And then, I guess, you know, one of the first trips to Hawaii, staying at the Volcom House, you know, around 2006, when it was, you know, the real Volcom House, you know, it was just like, shit, we're all staying in the Volcom House. And we turned up, and our beds were like bunk beds downstairs in this zone called the dungeon, which is just like underneath the house. And had to build the bunk beds straight away so we'd have somewhere to sleep that night, all flat packed. And, you know, I remember getting called out in front of the Volcom House by Kai Borgs, like one of the main big guys. And like, he's like, you need to be, you know, shaking everyone's hands and saying hi to everyone and get yourself known. And like, it was pretty scary when that guy pulled it up. And then, yeah, just of that, you know, video became a big part of my deal over the years. So it wasn't just shooting a lot of photos and, you know, filmed a lot of stuff and worked on all the major video productions pretty much since Creepy Fingers. And, that was pretty much it.
So can you give us a little bit of rundown? You started out shooting on slide film when you were probably pretty young, like 18, 19. How was that transition? What time frame was, can you give us like a little bit of a time frame around when analog switched to digital and what that was like as like a change up in, especially in the surf industry, you know, cause now it's a lot easier. Now you can send can you explain this, the process that you used to have to submit photos to magazines and then kind of how that changed?
Yeah. So I started off shooting the slide film. And some guys would get a lot of slide film from the magazine. The magazine, you know, was then entitled to sit on those photos and use them as they pleased. So I didn't have any retainers with the magazines at that stage. And so I'd go and buy a bulk roll of film. So I'd buy 100 feet of film and I'd put it in a canister and I'd roll my own film. And, you know, I could roll a film to like 38 degrees. And when you shot, you know, you shot to make every frame. It doesn't matter. You know, you'd send one photo. You know, if you have that slide, then that's it. No one else could have that slide unless you went out and got another scan, which is expensive at that time. So it was, you know, pretty slow distributing your photos on the slide. And a lot of guys from digital about kind of bought it and they went into it. And I took a bit of time to get into buying my first digital camera. And it was that transition period was like once I bought the camera, it took a while to kind of work it all out. But the business side of things is you could send your photos out to everyone, every magazine around the world at the same time. Email response to find out who wants this or that. It was huge. It was a huge difference. And, you know, as soon as I got to, like, the first kind of 3 months of that video, the digital camera, I was like, I wish I jumped on this straight away because, you know, but the magazine also weren't really ready to take digital files. And you see a lot of the published work around 2005 and they're really flat images and they didn't know how to. You know, and some people that they couldn't open raw files and send the file to a company to use. So there was a lot of a lot of change for a lot of people to learn and adapt to, and people didn't know a lot. So so I was lucky. I knew how to use Photoshop. I had a computer, and there was a lot of guys that didn't even have computers that, you know, they were buying a digital camera and a computer and trying to work it all out.
Do you think that analog era left a few of the old dinosaurs behind, or do you think that most of them, you know, evolved? Obviously, I'm sure you heard a lot of bitching and moaning. It's not the same aperture. It's not, you know, it's not the pixel relation isn't the same. Blah 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 blah. You know,
same guys. There's still people that just like. I just love the look of film. You know, it has its own look. And there was everyone just worked it out. You know, it took time, and the guys that were a bit slower on picking it up, the magazines would just say, just give us a hard drive and we'll deal with it. You know, a lot of the times, some guys still do, they just send the raw files off before they don't even edit them. They just go, here's the files, Dropbox it, and then somebody else deals with it. So I think the people that wanted those guys who were still good shooters, they still send them out to shoot. And then if they couldn't deal with the digital files and, you know, they just got somebody else to deal with it, you know, they got the shots they needed.
So you also worked as a staff photographer for Waves and for Tracks, is that correct?
Yeah.
How did that come about and what was that like back in the day? Obviously surfing was a lot more wild in the late 90s to kind of 2008 era, you know, that kind of all ended when the passing of Andy Irons maybe, or, you know, that you don't really see that rock star athlete partying the night before a world tour event and haven't for probably a long time, but you got to see probably the golden era of that age. What was it like back in the day working for, you know, rowdy publications like Tracks that were notorious for their all their antics and their partying and their interesting take on surfing. You know, it was Tracks was referred to as the Bible of surfing. And, you know, there were certain attitudes that were personified in that era by those publications.
Yeah, I guess things are definitely a lot more raw back in the day too. And, I used to only go to Hawaii in February, and then like December was like, if I stay at home, all the surf companies would have their Christmas parties, and it was just like every company was on the beaches or around Sydney. So yeah, there was some huge wild parties, and the Black Flies were involved then too, and they were doing some weird parties, and SMP ran some big ones as well, and Crank Magazine, another little magazine, they had some pretty big ones as well. So yeah, that was pretty, you know, pretty loose in those days. And then as far as the surfing goes, definitely, you know, guys started training and getting more healthy through the early 2000s, and you'd get guys coming in that were just super fit and didn't party and took it very seriously. And, you know, and the money got bigger too. So, you know, guys were starting to get, you know, Andy and Bruce were these huge wages, you know, but they were still partying, I guess. There are a lot of guys, you know, especially with Kelly. Kelly was, you know, really straight and he was winning everything, and that, I'm sure that helped inspire a lot of guys to take it very serious. And, you know, throughout the years, you know, right up, guys, you know, would be staying very healthy right up till the end of the year, and then you'd see them break loose when they, you know, made their goals or got to the end of the year or things like that.
So back in the day, what were some of the crazy places you got to go on trips? Like where and when and how did you go about organizing those trips? Did you, you know, would you used to write, did you ever write a story accompanying that, for the photos to accompany that story, and then, you know, hire, get the writers and then organize a boat trip or, you know, a trip to an exotic place like the Maldives or East Africa or the Bahamas maybe?
Yeah, I started, we usually start with a travel company and then organize a boat or a, you know, surf camp somewhere. And then I'd start talking with the companies and the magazine and just say, hey, Surf Travel Co. got a boat in Mentawai's, you know, what, you know, let's organize it. And I usually had a deal where I didn't have to pay to go if I organized a trip. And then I'd get a group of surfers through the companies and through guys I knew that I wanted to have on the trip, and then push it to the magazines. And then, you know, once the magazine run the story, companies get behind it and commit to sending the surfers.
And were there certain surfers that magazines like to use more because of the, you know, Volcom is, you know, putting a lot of money into, you know, running ads of Aussie Right? Was there, you know, was there a kind of a, you know, like an unspoken law that you, you know, to use these guys and you'd be more likely to get shots published and stuff like that?
Yeah, it's definitely a, you know, the magazines want to look after their advertisers. Advertisers, you know, look after certain magazines as well. So they'll be more inclined to send certain guys on certain trips with certain mags. And the other magazines would be wanting to push, you know, the big advertisers so they can get their, you know, get their advertising dollars. And so there's a big, strong side in that. And so being involved with Volcom was sometimes good, and sometimes, you know, they didn't want to get behind a trip I wanted to do as well. So, you know, it'd make it complicated being, you know, they'd have stuff for me to do, but they'd be like, oh, well, I've got this wave, trip for waves, and they wanted me to go to Bali or whatever, and they don't want a part of that. So there's complicated times like that where you need to be in two places at once.
Professional babysitting.
Yeah. Yeah, but I mean, they're all pretty, Volcom is pretty easy going with that stuff. Like if something was on like a trip like that, it happened, it was only 2 weeks. And usually they would work something into the mix where, you know, benefited Volcom as well while they're doing that stuff away. So we tried to still try to keep those things working in conjunction.
So surfing's a very political kind of boys club. You got the, you know, the amazing opportunity to shoot and hang out in the Volcom crew, which is probably definitely the most infamous surf brand that had a culture built around its, you know, the heavies that were involved in it, like Kyborg and, you know, potentially Eddie Rothman and all those other people from the North Shore and, you know, the Wolf Pack, et cetera. What was the sentiment towards, you know, obviously you're a bit of a fly on the wall, you're a pretty nice guy. What was the sentiment of people on the outside looking into the little zone that you guys occupied on the North Shore, like right on the beach at Pipeline? Was there like animosity, or was there like people would paddle out and surf and then people would move out of the way? And, you know, what was that like being a fly on the wall during that era?
Yeah, I guess it's pretty intimidating for a lot of people. I remember the first trips too I did to Hawaii before I was staying with those guys, and you know, everyone was like so cautious of, you know, what they're doing in Hawaii. Even just you go to the food land or whatever, and you'd be like, you know, be careful, because you know, as you'd see, you know, people get pulled up quite a lot earlier in the days, not so much in the later days. And then, you know, I guess the Hawaiians, they've always had like these hordes of people coming to the North Shore every year. And so, you know, they need to make a stand, and otherwise they wouldn't get any waves. And it's such a dangerous wave as well, the pipeline. You know, it just goes with the territory.
So did you find the sentiment changed a lot from the local people when you were there working and representing Volcom and in that little clique? Did things become a lot easier?
Yeah, I guess. They like, when I started saying that, those guys were really good to me, and they really kind of got behind me and, you know, really nice to me and just, you know, looked after me. So, yeah, I guess, you know, things definitely got a lot easier. You know, I never had that feeling like, you know, you could get in trouble for this or that. You know, you can still can. And being in the Volcom House, there's a lot of, like, heavy dudes around them all the time, and you kind of like, you know, a bit intimidating. But yeah, once you got to know them, you know, they're like really nice people, really good people. You know, and they sort of people would just do anything they can for you. They give you the shirt off their back if they, you know, thought you needed a t-shirt.
And how many seasons did you spend in Hawaii?
I think I went every year since 2001 till 2015. And sometimes I'd go twice, because then we had, you know, the Triple Crown through November, December, and then we'd also have, you know, the Pipe Pro January, February as well. So I'd probably come back for Christmas and then get back over there and just do the late season. So I spent a lot of time in Hawaii over the last 15 years.
You also spent a lot of time in France. How did that come about, working with Volcom Europe? Your wife is French. She's from the Basque country, I'm pretty sure. You want to give us a little info on?
Yeah. So I kind of always could never get a trip to go to France. I always wanted to have a trip to go to France. And then I started dating this girl who was from Hossegor. And after like a year and a bit, her visa ran up, she had to go home. And that was about 2009. And
did you meet her here in Australia or in France?
I met her here in Manly.
Oh, and, random.
She kind of, a lot of people I knew from them going to France to do the Con Air, so kind of had people that friends in common. And so when it came down to her going home, Volcom Europe needed a guy over there to shoot, and you know, everyone was got talking to Volcom, and they gave me that opportunity to spend that time in France, and you know, we continued our relationship, and you know, we ended up getting married through that. And that, you know, probably would have been pretty hard to continue that relationship without, you know, Volcom making that deal happen. And so it's probably about 6 years of going to France every year for their summer, which is a really fun place to be. And I was just there. Volcom have a house in Hossegor as well. So, well, they had a house in Hossegor, and their whole team stayed there through the summer. And so we just worked with their team, surfing with King Louie through the summer. That's it.
So you guys, So you worked in, what was the difference between working with Volcom Europe and say working with Volcom Australia or Volcom America?
Yeah, well, there were times where things got a little bit complicated. Things kind of overlapped a bit because I ended up having like five different bosses, because there was Volcom Australia, there was Volcom America was like the video guys, and then there was like the guys who want photos as well. So that had different needs and wants, and then I'd be, you know, have the Europe guys, and they'd have their team, But wherever I was, there was a mix of guy surfers from America, Europe, and Australia. So there's always something to do with, you know, a list of different things to get with different guys. So you kind of like trying to tick a lot of boxes, and, you know, there's probably five different bosses you kind of need to do stuff for. So sometimes you just get a bit overloaded with different stuff you got to do at the same time. And then, yeah, in France too, like when the Quick Pro came and like guys like Dusty and stuff would turn up, you know, I'd have to spend some time with Dusty, and, you know, it wasn't easy to do the Europe job at the same time as well. You know, everyone wants to surf in different spots, same different times, and yeah, you can't be everywhere. So that side got a bit more complicated, but, you know, it's what it had to be to make it work.
So tell us, over the last few years, the surfing world's kind of changed. You know, Quicksilver owns Billabong. You know, the whole world's kind of, especially now with this COVID stuff. How have you seen the transition as a photographer and a filmmaker working for, you know, on a consistent wage with these big companies that had a lot more marketing dollars to throw around, you know, 5-10 years ago? How's your position of how you make money change? Like how you actually get a dollar out of from the end user? Obviously, you shoot a cover now, it's what, worth 15 grand, 1500 bucks, two grand, is it, for a cover these days? More?
Not much.
Not even that much.
I think it was like 1000 bucks. And then I don't really get much out of the surf companies these days, but
how much was a cover back in the day? How much would a cover have paid back in the day?
I think Tracks is 1,000 to 1,200, and Surfer and Surfing US mags were probably 1,500 to 2 grand US.
So it hasn't dropped that much then.
Yeah, and now it's like 500 bucks for a cover. And getting a cover back in the day was the best shot one, always. You know, right from the start, it was like, if you got the cover, that was, you know, you had the best shot that month. And then as time progressed, covers became bought, and if you got a cover, it was kind of because, you know, there was an incentive for a company to get that cover. And I got a cover of Aussie once, and it was definitely not one of the best photos of Aussie. It just happened to be the best photo of Aussie at the time, and they wanted to, I guess, and maybe they had a deal with Bolton or something. They need to.
Was that for an Australian magazine?
Yeah. So that was, I think as it progressed, getting a cover, you know, became less of a big deal than what it was. Originally, you know, you'd get paid the top dollar for the cover, and, you know, there was a lot that went with actually getting that cover. And towards the end, it was kind of like, you're still stoked because you still got the cover, but you got a little bit less money, and, you know, it wasn't because it was the best shot that you got that cover. You got that cover because of more political reasons or, you know, business reasons.
And working for Volcom helped a lot with, you know, getting certain shots published. Did you fox with American magazines much, like Surfer and stuff like that? Did you get much stuff published internationally?
Yeah, I had a good relationship with Surfer, and probably more with Surfing. And those guys at Surfing Magazine, were just, you know, I'd hang out with them when we were in Hawaii. And just good people to hang out with. And they're always, you know, they're still supportive now, even though that magazine doesn't exist anymore. Those guys are still in touch.
Did you ever get any covers of any international magazines?
Yeah, like a few of the Europe magazines. Never got a US magazine cover. My deal wasn't really, like, if I worked for magazines and I was working more on an editorial basis, then, you know, I would have got more covers, but, you know, my priority of my photos were to Volcom. So they got the first pick, which, you know, and after that, you know, if they needed it for an ad and company, a magazine wanted for a cover, you'd go to the ad, not the cover.
So as you've changed from working as an employee to a kind of like an independent contractor, how has your life changed? Obviously, a lot of photographers out there in the surfing world were probably already doing that, but you had the privilege to work for a big brand for so many years. Was it a tough transition, you know, trying to make ends meet from in the new digital era of Instagram and where everyone's a photographer and, you know?
Yeah. Well, after I left the contracting world and being working freelance, I knew for a long time it was coming, and I knew it was going to be hard. And when it happened, it was a lot harder than what I thought it was going to be. It's been pretty tough. And we had a kid during the same time as well, so all your spare time, all your time goes into the baby, and then you've got to run your business, and you've got to find work all the time, and it's the transition's been massive, it's been huge.
And what kind of other work do you do on the side to make ends meet in living in, Sydney's one of the top three most expensive places in the world to live. You know, you live on top of each other. Still, Northern Beaches is still a pretty beautiful place to live. Have you found that the surf industry's kind of moved on from Sydney? And, what kind of other odd jobs do you have to do day to day now to be able to, live your life as a photographer and filmmaker?
Yeah, definitely the surf industry has probably moved to the Gold Coast now. There's a lot of attention up there, and a lot of the best surfers live on the Gold Coast. We used to have all the best surfers living on all the beaches. Now there's still a couple of guys that have surfed really good, but definitely can't make a living as you would before. And then just now it's making videos for businesses. There's a lot of events, a lot of work in the city as well, which is a good resource of work. And then locally there's a lot of real estate work as well, but it's a real mixed bag of who you work for. And
you enjoyed that transition of, like, obviously you were doing that, you would, as exciting as it is, variety is the spice of life, and you spent all these years herding cats of pro athletes and models and traveling to all these exotic locations, and it's an amazing life that you've got to live. But have you found that, going to a little bit of normality has been, good for you? Or do you miss the days of consistently being on a plane and having new stamps in your passport?
Yeah, it's a bit of a double standard. I guess I was craving it towards the end of my deal, and I was getting tired of doing so much traveling, and I was it'd be nice just to be home. And now I'm home quite a lot now, and really missing the travel and a lot of the guys. This whole world you have when you're doing that, all these people, you just all of a sudden don't see anymore. So there's a lot of guys and crew, that I miss, that, I used to hang out with all the time. So that's probably the biggest change. And work-wise too, it didn't even feel like work before. I didn't even think about it. It was just, it's your passion that you're working on, so you wake up every morning, you go out and you do it. Whereas now, certain things you do, there's, you got to take the good with the bad, and there's some jobs you just got to deal with and take and do it. And there's some jobs, that you get to do some different stuff now, which is really cool.
And so moving forward, in a post-COVID world, What's been paying the bills of late?
Through this lockdown period, the real estate stuff is massive. But now it's kind of slowing down a bit. And, there's a few projects on the horizon that we're trying to work out with our curators of culture. And there's another potential cooking show. There's a few different things coming up. So there's another one with a kids kind of well-being and
sounds pretty. Sounds interesting. And so, tell me, where do you see the surfing world and action sports in general heading after all this BS has happened? Do you think that the the WSL will probably survive, but do you think that we'll see a tour for 2021?
Yeah, they're just going to have to scale right back down. I think, we'll probably see events being run in, being run on a live broadcast and not so much about the getting people to the event. And, there's going to be a lot less money in it for everyone. People are going to be doing the events just for the fun of it, for their passion. Definitely won't be any huge contracts going down like there were before, and there won't be, I don't know if they'll have the money for some crazy locations like Fiji and places like that were pretty expensive to run those events. Even Trestles is a really expensive event for those guys to run. So we're probably going to see events run more cost-effective places.
And Do you keep your ear to the grindstone in the surfing world? How are you hearing about a lot of people being laid off and kind of things starting to crumble? Or you think that recession's 6 months to a year before we feel the real effects of it?
I think we're going to see a lot of effects, change throughout the year. I heard a lot of surfers there treated as contractors, and their contracts are just put on hold indefinitely until this whole thing clears up. And I've heard a lot of surf companies have had big layoffs, so there's a lot of people working there and lost their jobs, and they just had to scale their businesses right back because they can't have shops open. There's no retail, they're not getting money from retail. And the surfers, there's a lot of the surfers now, they're not traveling, they're not going to events, they're home, the guys in Europe, they are in California, they can't even go surfing. The beaches are closed, so it's all on hold right now. And for the way it's going to pan out, it's probably going to unfold quite slowly. And it'll start off with a lot of online only events.
So you think that's the immediate future is kind of similar to what the UFC did recently on Fight Island, where they had a broadcast of a fight with no crowd? Is that basically what you think? They'll pick an island in the middle of the Mentawais or, some kind of more of a video competition or just like live heats that are broadcast on the internet kind of thing?
Yeah. I've seen there's a thing Live Heats did, and they did a video competition for all the surf clubs, and that's gone out really well. Back in the day they did an event in Mentawais, which was pretty sick. They needed about 10 to 15 boats to house all the surfers and all the judges and everything else, and they ran the event in the Mentawais. If they did something like that, it would be amazing. But Mentawais is still locked down at the moment. There's no surfing there right now.
So how long do you reckon before all this, you've spent a lot of time around Indonesia and in the Southern Pacific, how long do you reckon before all this stuff kind of dies down and we're allowed to travel again? From your perspective, obviously, no one really knows, but what do you think? What would your bet, if you're a betting man, what would your money be on? How long?
Yeah, I reckon everyone wants to get things rolling again, and you can see that, and you can see it just down, around here, people are just, they're not staying home, they're living their lives.
No, everyone's fucking over it. Everyone just wants to go back to living their normal life.
So I think, within 3 months, I think we'll see some of the events going. Football's planning events now. And I think it's, surfing's a safer location than a football field or a stadium. So I think, I'm sure surfing's going to start kick back off. It's just going to be a matter of getting all the surfers to one spot to attend the event, and it might take some guys to wait for certain areas to finish their lockdown so those athletes can get out of, the French guys can get out of France and they can get to the Gold Coast or wherever it is the event's going to be so they can have the event. There should be probably a lot of catching up to do as well, so we might see a big influx of events and a lot of stuff happening, and they could probably pull out a still pull out a world title this year.
So tell us, where do you see the digital scape going as a way to make money, or if you could talk to your 18-year-old self now, coming in, and your 18-year-old self was living in today's day and age, how would you advise your younger self in order to be able to create the life that you've created over the last 20 years and become a content creator in the video and photography space for action sports?
Yeah, I guess the best advice is probably focus on, constantly learn, keep focus on learning and embrace new technologies. Don't be like everyone when digital cameras came out and just said, fuck that, I'm not doing digital, and then you got to do digital. So embrace technology, know your business, learn your business, because if you're not good at running your business, you don't have business, you don't have money. And then
so basically learn the fundamentals of learn financial aptitude, as Brandon Lowry would say.
Yeah. Got to pay the bills, and you got to make sure you can continue doing that. And the business model of being a photographer is that you're always buying new gear. You need bits and pieces. You need a friction arm, or you need a whatever you need. You need stuff all the time, and so you're always spending money on gear. And so you've got this constant expense too, and then you need to deal with that, and then pay the rest of your bills, and you want to make money and have a retirement sometime.
So we're going to do this. I want to do this one thing before I get you off the phone. I want to ask you three different questions that are just totally random. This segment's called Random Rants. And I just want to put forward three random questions to you. If you could go on a surf trip anywhere in the world right now with anyone, dead or alive, with three surfers you could shoot, who would they be and why?
Tough question. I guess, I'd invite Ozzy. There's really too many guys to really pick from. I'll just pick the three main guys that I always work with, because that was...
And who are they?
Fun guys to travel with. Maybe Ozzy, maybe Alex Gray, maybe... and maybe another one of the Euro guys, William Maliotti. He was a lot of fun to shoot and travel with. And then those three guys.
If there was one thing you could change about the surf industry, what would it be and why? Mr. Controversial over here.
Yeah, I don't know. Where would you start? Where would you finish with the surf industry? Actually, working out of the surf industry now, there's a lot of things I thought was more insular, particular to the surf industry, but working with corporate companies and so forth. And they can be just as disorganized and half-assed as anyone in the surf industry as well. So I wouldn't say, how the surf industry is run as much, because you deal with that everywhere. It's just people. I don't know. I always felt like, the people at the bottom of the ladder, need to be taken care of a bit better, because that was always where, surfing got its bad name, because guys would be, weren't treated well, and then turn around and just say, oh, surfing is so bad, it gets a bad name. And those things, they didn't need to be that way. Couldn't just been a bit better organized and planned, and people would be more happy, and surf industry wouldn't have a bad name.
Okay, so last question. So you're married to a lovely French lady. Can you tell me, what was it like? What's it like when you guys are yelling at each other and, the communication barrier goes a little askew and AY? Obviously, she probably speaks pretty good English. Does your wife swear at you in French ever?
No, she doesn't yell at me in French. he wasn't the baby, you know, our kid in French, because he's, you know, he's learning his French. But, yeah, I don't get yelled at in French. Her English is better than mine. She yells at me in English. I can understand that.
All right. Awesome, Andrew. Thanks for your time, buddy. We'll catch up soon.
All right. Sweet. Cheers.
See you, buddy. Peace.